convene the regular supplemental meetings, and I'll call to order. I'd like to go ahead and recess the supplemental meeting. So the first thing we'd like to do is a moment of silence, honoring all the people who have been part of the system who are not with us anymore. Thank you. We'll now move to the consent agenda. And the first item within the consent agenda is the minutes from the last meeting. Are there any comments at all on those meeting minutes? And so if not, can I have a motion to approve the September 9 meeting minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carried. Next, we have the detailed consent agenda. Any comments? If not, we'd like to go ahead and someone like to make a motion.
Just a quick question, Kelly. Why would new people go into drop? Is it just a tax deferral issue? Or?
So once they reach their 90% maximum benefit, it makes sense for them to go into drop, unless they think they might get promoted and their average salary is going up. But we've only had one person since 2017 go into drop that hadn't hit the 90% maximum benefit. So that's
just a tax deferral for them? Is that what's
going on? No, they're accumulating a balance. It's basically their pension's not going to go up anymore, so they might as well start collecting it. So they're accumulating a balance. Pardon me?
I said if they don't retire and they're maxed out.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But we run a report every, I don't know if it's every month or every quarter, but we call people and let them know you're going to be
okay.
The one thing also you might have noticed on the consent agenda is there's just a ton of retirements on here. That is common for this time of year, that we typically have a lot of retirements in September, October, because they used to plan that joining draw and retiring around when you get the COLA.
Okay, I'll move approval.
We have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. So now we'd like to go to give anyone who's there in the public would like to make any comments. Do we have anybody who would like to do so?
You'll put us on 5-star on your phone, and we'll unmute you so you can make a comment.
So nothing?
I don't see anything.
Okay. All right, let's move on. So next we're going to go to Brenda, who is going to talk to us about the financial audit status and movement thereupon.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. I am happy to report that we received the audited financial statements for Hub Energy on September 28th. So these audited financials were the last ones that we were waiting on in order to complete our financials. With the receipt of these statements, we were able to send our financials to the actuaries. They've begun work on the actuarial evaluation. We expect to receive that actuary report around the end of October, beginning of November, and that should be presented at the November board meeting. Once we have the actuary report, we think that we will finish our audited financials in about 30 days. So we expect to present the audited financials at the December board meeting. In the meantime, staff continues to work on the parts of the audited financials and the annual report that we can as we wait for these last pieces, and hope to have them finished up as soon as we can. Any questions about the audited financial statement?
So what would be your target date for the comprehensive annual report?
So I expect to give a report on that in December.
Okay.
It should be substantially complete. We may be polishing up a little bit, but the audited financials as well as the annual report would be reported in December.
So you think it's reasonable to think by the end of the year we'd just be distributed?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, great.
Any questions?
No. So I think we're going to move to you as well to talk about your initial reading and discussion of the 2022 budget.
Yes. Thank you, John. If you'll move to the next page. So I'm going to be presenting the proposed 2022 budget this morning. I'm going to start with a look at the summary budget, then look at some variances on specific accounts, review the detailed budget, and then end with looking at some expense trends. Just in general, I want to say the 2021 actual expenses, some of them such as board and staff travel, conferences, office supplies are still lower than our pre-pandemic levels in 2019, so you will see that as you look at the reports here. We did budget with the expectation that 2022 will return to more normalized levels. We're going to start, the schedule that you're looking at is the summary budget schedule. And for those of you who may not have seen this schedule before, I just want to orient you a little bit to what the schedule looks like. You will see information on the 2021 budget, the 2021 projected actual, the 2022 budget, and then both dollar and percentage variances comparing the two budgets year over year, as well as comparing the 2022 budget to where we believe that we will end 2021. We track our expenses kind of in three broad categories: administrative, investment, and professional expenses. And just looking at the big picture, the total budget for 2022 is $21.7 million. And you'll find that about the middle of the page on that total line in that third column, $21.7 million is the total budget. That's compared to $23.6 million for the 2021 budget, so down almost $1.9 million or 8%. And that decline is primarily driven by declines in management fees, and we'll talk about that a little as we move on. Also, when you compare the 2021 projected actual of $24 million, it's down, the 2022 budget is below that by $2.3 million, or about 9.7%, and that decline is driven largely by investment-related expenses.
Are you going to get into more detail? I mean, we see from the investment expenses were way over budget this year. What drove that, and then why we're projecting it's going to be dramatically lower next year?
Yes.
Okay.
So the 2021 projected actual budget exceeds the 2021 budget. So if you'll look at projected actual is $24 million. It actually has exceeded the 2021 budget by about $441,000. This budget overage is driven by investment legal expenses, and we'll discuss that in more detail during the closed session.
Brenda, would you do one thing, just a quick overview of where changes in NAV for any sort of investment begin and end, and where investment expenses kick in, just so that everyone understands from a category standpoint?
Sure. So in the investment expenses, we include items like custodian charges, management fees. The NAV is not included in those types of expenses that you see here. They roll through in the net investment income.
But to the extent that a manager runs expenses through their fund, then those are captured in NAV, and then things that are specific expenses to us, we run through investment expenses.
Right.
So that's a fair...
Yeah, like, for example, on like AEW, where we're directly on real estate, we have to pay directly for audits and appraisals. Those run through the budget, but if we invested in that through a fund, that would be a fund-level expense, and our NAV would just be decreased.
Yes.
For that type of expense.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. The bottom line, the adjusted total excludes legal fees, just an addition this year. And when you compare the 2021 adjusted budget of $22.8 million and the adjusted 2021 projected actual at $21.4 million, you'll see excluding legal expenses, the system is under their budget for 2021 by almost $1.4 million. John, if you'll skip ahead a couple of pages, one more. We'll come back to those detailed lines. What I want to look at next is the variances. And we look at variances in two categories. We compare the year-over-year budget, 2021 and 2022, and see what variances are there. And then we compare the 2022 budget to our 2021 projected actual. So this first schedule is comparing the two budget years to see what variances are there. And we detail out and we examine in more detail any variances that are greater than 5% and $10,000. So that's what you see here highlighted. I won't go through all of them, but I do want to touch on a couple of them that are significant there. First, let's look at the increases. The first line is other portfolio operating expenses. So this is where investment legal expenses, appraisal, audit, anything related to investments are captured in this line. The year-over-year budgets are up $204,000 or 26.2%. We have budgeted some increased legal fees related to some of the investments, and that increase in the legal fees was partially offset by declines in expected costs for investment audits and appraisals and other fees. The layout of this schedule is much as you saw on the summary, with the addition on the right-hand side of an explanation column that you can see some of these explanations there. The next item with an increase is public relations. We met and talked with Fleshman Hilliard last month. This is a placeholder for a possible communications project with them in 2022.
And if I can interrupt, Brenda, this is really a placeholder. So once they come back with their next phase, we'll know what this number should be. So we could zero this out now if you want, leave it at 100 or put some other number in there, but whatever you prefer then.
Thank you, Kelly. As we move down and we look at reductions, the first reduction is investment management fees. We're projecting them to decline $2.2 million when the two budgets are compared, and that is related specifically to a decline in fee rate as well as some decline in the overall portfolio value. And that is also being affected by the asset allocation as we are moving more items into the global equity account.
So a lot of that, just the distributions of private assets and the write-downs of private assets that we've had reducing fees, or is it mostly?
And the write-downs really affect it because they're based on commitments usually, but a lot of the troubled privates were beyond the fee stage of them, but it's selling a lot of the other private assets and reallocating that into, you know, a 2% fee into a 50 to 60 basis point fee in equity.
Good point.
The next item I want to mention is the independent audit, down $63,000 or 38%. If you will recall, earlier this year we did an RFP for audit services, and as a result of that RFP, we were able to negotiate lower fees, and so that is reflected in the budget. If we'll go to the next page, John. So this is a similar schedule to what you previously saw, but this is comparing the 2022 budget to the 2021 projected actual. Same format of increases and decreases. Let's start by looking at a few of the increases. Legal fees. One thing I do want to mention is since this budget was prepared, the 2021 projected actual for legal fees has increased by about $80,000. So with that adjustment, the legal fee budget is going to be up about $418,000, comparing the 2022 budget to the 2021 projected actual. These legal fees for the actuary, open records, USERRA cases, they were significantly less in 2021 than what we had anticipated. If we look at the next item, salaries and benefits, $420,000 or 12% when compared to the projected actual. The reason for the increase that is being shown is our actual is less because we currently have three staff vacancies. We expect and hope that we will have those filled by the end of the year and that we will be fully staffed again in 2022.
Do you have a salary increase built into the budget as well?
We do also. We have a 2.5%. I was going to get there, but I'm glad you brought it up. We, again, as a placeholder, have a 2.5% salary increase built into the number as well.
I'm actually seeing people using more like 3%.
Right.
A couple of the other studies I've been involved in.
So we are actually having CBIZ do a little more work for us related to the compensation plan, which is due in December, and with that, we may come back and increase that. We'll talk to them before the November meeting about that. Thank you.
The last one of the increases that I'll mention are is in information technology projects. The projects that have been completed so far in 2021 have come in under budget, which is having the actual number be lower. And one project that we had thought would be completed in 2021 has been deferred until 2022. So that is showing an increase when you compare the actual to the budget. You'll notice there are quite a few other increases, but many of them are related to the reduced 2021 expenses due to the pandemic. Again, travel, conferences, supplies. I won't go through them in detail, but you'll see them listed there along with their explanation. As we look at the reductions, other portfolio operating expenses down $2.8 million. These expenses are driven in large part by end-of-life private equity expenses. We did incur significant unbudgeted expenses in 2021, and again, as I mentioned, we'll discuss those in more detail in the closed session. Again, investment management expenses, when you compare the actual to the 2022 budget, down about $1 million, same thing with rates and fees. Now, John, I'll ask you if you'll go back to page 18, back a couple of pages. Right there, thank you. This slide is our budget. So on the summary slide, you saw the breakdown of the three broad categories, administrative, investment, and professional. This slide actually breaks down and shows all of the components of the in that summary slide. What are the components of the administrative versus the investment versus the professional? One thing that I did want to mention on this slide, because it didn't get picked up in either of the two previous variances, is that salaries and budget number, where it shows that there's an increase of about $144,000 when you compare to the proposed budget year over year. Again, we mentioned a 2.5% placeholder for salaries. We do expect some increases in our benefit costs as well. Year over year, we have planned for both 21 and 22 for a total of 25 staff members. That is still the case, 25 staff members for 2022, but there has been a position consolidation and a shift of positions. So although there's 25, they're in a little bit different configuration that also is contributing to that increase as well. Jonathan, go to the next page.
I have a question.
Yes.
And I think this was brought up before, and I'm not sure if it was resolved. I just, if someone would jog my memory. What were we doing with the vacation days that were not taken during COVID year?
So anyone who had vacation days left over at the end of 2020, all the years now are rolling together, at the end of 2020 was allowed to roll them over into 2021, and they were given one additional year to use of those days. But at the end of 2021, if they have not used those days that they rolled over, then they will lose them. So they were given 1 year grace to use those unexpired days, or expired days.
Okay. Hey, Brenda, it's Armando.
Yes.
Hey, just a quick question. At the end of 2021, if those days are still unused, is the ability there for the employees to or the staff to sell them back to DPFP and get paid out at straight time value?
No.
Okay.
The agreement that we made was they would be given a one additional year to use them. If they have not used them, then they will lose them. There is no ability to sell them back.
Are most people using it then, or?
There's a few of us that still have problems, but you know, Carol's doing a good job of telling us that what we need to do, and we all know what we need to do.
I guess that's my point is. You know, we're a small staff, and only so many people can be off at a certain amount of time. We've got so many big issues coming up. I just don't want to penalize somebody for doing their job. If there's any way, you know, to work through that. I was just thinking about it. But yeah, if y'all have a plan for it, sounds good to me.
I feel comfortable with where we are. I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but I feel like the people that have the problem are the, like, Josh and I.
Yes.
And I don't care about Josh.
No.
Well, all right, then.
It's the frontline counselors that are really the issue. It's more of on the executive level, and we're okay with that. We're okay with losing them if we need to. That's part of the job.
Yeah, but part of the job is self-care also, and I don't want you guys to burn out either over this pandemic, so... I appreciate your dedication, but at the same time, I want you to take care of yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I do care.
John, if I can get you to go back one page, please. I do want to point out here at the bottom of this detailed line budget, you'll see the supplemental budget at the very bottom, and we do allocate 0.85% of our expenses to the supplemental budget. So you'll see that there in total, and there's about a $20,000 variance depending on how you which comparison that you take. Are there any questions about the variances or the detailed budget?
Brenda, this is Michael Brown. Did our existing auditors reduce their fees, or are we getting a new auditor?
It is the same auditor, and the auditors reduced their fees.
One of the things we did is we allowed them to outsource offshore to one of their affiliates to reduce the cost of a lot of the manual ticking and checking that is done, and that was a big part of reducing our fee.
And a lot of auditors are moving toward that direction anyway.
Yeah. So it's the same auditor, but with a reduced cost, but they have a reduced cost as well.
Right. And I do want to just add to that, saying we did add a requirement that they could not outsource anything that related to our members. So there would be no member information that was going overseas. All of that will remain here within the state.
Thank you.
Yes, certainly. So if there's no questions here, we'll go a couple of slides further. I want to end one more. Right here. Thank you, John. I want to end by just looking at some variances. So these are a comparison of the expenses by the kind of broad categories that we talked about, administration, investment, and professional. What I've also added on here is a category called investment funds. And these are those management fees that are paid by the fund and not directly by BTFP, so through the fund. So we can kind of track those expenses as well. You can see, this is from 2016 actual and goes through the period to 2022 budget. There were significant declines in investment and professional fees from the high periods of 2016-2017. And although as you look at some of the categories, you will see the proposed 2022 budget is showing some increases over the 2021 projected actuals. Keep in mind that is still the COVID, reduced COVID expenses affecting 2021. If you just look at the budgets year over year for both administration and for professional, you will see the budgets for both 21 and 22 are about the same. Investment expenses, not the fund, but the other investment expenses, are down about $1.4 million. That's when you compare to the 2021 projected actual. And again, this is due to an increase in legal costs associated with our private equity funds, and we'll discuss that more in closed session. The investment fees that are manager fees, you see, are down significantly from both the 2021 budget and the 2021 projected actual. Again, a lot of the asset allocation changes are driving that decline in the fund fees. Any questions about the expense comparison or any other part of the budget? Okay. If there's no questions, I'll throw it back to you, Nick.
Can you put the discussion sheet on the screen?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thanks, Kelly. So we would like to, this is the staff recommendation, to revise the proposed budget, give us some direction to revise the budget, and we'll bring the revised budget back at the November board meeting and then authorize forwarding the proposed budget to the city and for posting it on the website.
And we are presenting the budget to the city at the October meeting with this budget and any changes that you might have today.
Right,
October
25th.
What's the feedback loop? Like, with the city when there's deviations from the budget? Is there anything?
No, our budget is a little bit unique where we have no, unlike a city, we don't have a budget, a statutory budget requirement. I mean, the different states I've lived in kind of do it differently. Sometimes you legally can't overspend your total city budget, and sometimes you can't overspend your department budget. But for the pension, and I did a lot of research on this when I first got here, there really is no legal requirement about what happens if you overspend your budget. And the city, we tell them where we're going to be, and we really haven't had a problem with overspending our budget since I've been here. We've done, one year we had a few budget amendments, and then we're proposing a budget amendment today, but we don't really check in with them other than at this time of the year.
I was just more curious what the feedback loop was as you get actuals versus budget. But, okay. All right, so I think I want to throw it open. Is there any comments or questions? And if not, then I think we'd like to go ahead and make a motion along the lines of the staff recommendation. Someone like to make that motion?
I'll make it, Nick. It's Gilbert.
Okay. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No? Okay, the motion carries. Kelly, okay. To you on the staff retirement plan.
Thank you. Right. Good morning, everyone. On page 26 of Diligent, you'll see a PowerPoint presentation on the staff retirement plan.
Is this in the PDF that you sent out?
Yes.
Where is that on in this? Right, go into Diligent. I just.
Oh, page, it should still be page 26 of the.
And it should be the same in the PDF.
In the PDF.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
So this is a discussion related to the DPFP staff, not the DPFP members, and what to do with our retirement program going forward, and to remind you and to let any new board members know, this is an issue that we've really been talking about for a couple of years, and we've looked at a variety of options on what to do with the staff retirement plan, and TMRS seems to be the best option. The reason that we are looking at changing our retirement plan is because currently the DPFP pays into a defined contribution plan for staff members, but there is no lifetime guaranteed benefit stream of any dollars to the staff members, and the staff doesn't participate in Social Security. So it doesn't seem like the staff actually are some of the very few people in Texas that have no guaranteed payment of any type in their retirement. So we were trying to solve that issue. And
wasn't part of that, in order to attract people to the system,
right.
People would have to give up their DB plan somewhere else to come here, and that's been more difficult to get people to do that.
Exactly, and also a lot of cities in Texas are in TMRS, so if we want to attract somebody from another city, they would have to give up their TMRS plan to come to DPFP, and we have seen that to be an issue in our recruiting in the past. So that's really what this item is about. And I wanted to go through in a little more detail than we have in the past about how TMRS works. But really, the whole point of this is using the same dollars DPFP is already putting into the retirement plan in a more effective manner. We're not talking about putting more money into a retirement system for the staff that the system isn't already putting in. We're not talking about giving them another benefit on top of the benefit they already have. It's really about using the current dollars in a better way. They're based on the numbers that we have now, TMRS is actually cheaper than the current plan that we have. And a concern for some of the members have been that we're double dipping, that we're getting something in addition. But so I wanted to just put out there, every single employee is going to start with a zero balance. So the time that you have been with DPFP prior to this doesn't give you any benefit in TMRS. There's no, your retirement benefit's not going to be bigger in the future because of that. Your contributions in the future will only relate to your service once we get into TMRS. So there's no double dipping in that respect. Are there questions about that piece before I go on? Because those seem to be the issues of the members.
Why did that issue come up at all?
I think people think that we're somehow getting our prior benefit and then this benefit for the time we've already served, and it's a double dipping situation, but it's not. TMRS starts at zero once we start participating and then goes from there.
And so what happens to the previous contribution?
The money that the staff members have in their 401A plan will stay over there. We can't roll it into TMRS.
Yeah. And that's why I think it needs to be as well stated.
Right. It's what you have over there, and everybody starts new going forward.
Kelly, the existing balances, can those be rolled to an outside self-managed plan?
Yeah, Michael, they can. And so we have a 401A plan that we're the staff currently in. We also have a 457. Those are currently with Voya. We anticipate keeping the 457 with Voya. We may close the 401A and need to roll those into individual IRAs or something like that. But we will do something with it. We have current employees in the 401A as well as former employees with their money there. So we'll have to find out if the best option is another provider staying with Voya or everybody just does their own individual thing going forward with the balances that they have. The only thing we know for sure is we can't put it in a TMRS.
Thank you.
Hey, Kelly, this is Ken. I got one question on the 401. Is that with Prudential?
It's with Voya.
Okay, so both are with Voya. Has Voya offered any type of instruction or meetings with the employees as to what they can do with their money if they stay, or contact information that they may need, you know, whether it's on the web or in person?
We have not gone that far, Ken, with Voya yet because we want to find out what the board's direction is. We have a conversation with Voya to look at what our options are, but we haven't taken the next step to say, okay, we're really going to do this. What are the actual options for the individual employee? We haven't gone there yet, but we definitely would if the board decides to move forward with this.
Okay, just to let you know, from my 401 and 457 days with the city, I know locally the Voya rep, if he's still there. If you need any help in that, just reach out to me and I'll contact him. If it's not him locally that can do anything, I'm sure he can tell me who to contact if you need it.
Okay, thank you, Ken. So just to remind you where we are, when we last spoke of the 401 or the staff retirement plan, we came to the board and we were asking for approval to seek legislative change to allow DPFP staff to enter into TMRS. We were able to pass a bill to get that access, so that's where we are now. So the board now has the option. We have the legal authority to join TMRS, but it's the board's option on whether we join TMRS or we continue with the current plan. So today, the purpose of the meeting today is to give you an overview of TMRS, to discuss the options that the board will have to make if we do join, and then to get any feedback from you on additional information that you need. We can also bring in somebody from TMRS if you think that would be helpful. I'm not requesting action at today's meeting for two reasons. Three reasons. This is a big decision. It's an irrevocable decision, so I want to make sure you get all your questions answered. There's some cost data that I don't have that I'll talk about a little bit, and there's also very specific wording on what the board motion would need to be, and I don't have that wording yet from TMRS. So my thought is we would get feedback today and be able to address any issues you have. If you want, bring in a TMRS rep and bring this back in November.
So beginning with a financial snapshot, TMRS is a very well-funded plan. They're currently, on a composite basis, 89.5% funded. The top graph there shows their funding over time. It's important to understand, however, that the composite funded ratio is for all of the cities combined in TMRS, and every city, and when I'm saying city related to TMRS, we're a city, so city with quotes, DPFP is a city basically. We would all have our own individual funding percentage, and that's calculated every year. And that actual funding level determines the employer contribution rate. And we'll talk more about that in the presentation. But overall, TMRS is very well funded. There's 895 cities. You'll see I use the total number of cities differently in this presentation. It just depends on the source I was using. But I'm using TMRS numbers. 205,000 members and retirees are in TMRS. Their annual contributions are $1.7 billion, benefit payments $1.5 billion, their net position is $34.5 billion, or $34.3 billion. I included in the agenda materials a summary of their annual financial report, their full financial reports obviously on their website, as well as their valuations. They have a well-diversified portfolio. The pie chart and their holdings are in the materials I provided. There's nothing unusual in their allocation that I saw. Their annual assumed rate of return is 6.75, and you can see that over the 3 years they were under that by about a quarter of a percentage, but other than that they've met it or exceeded it on the 1, 5, and 10 years. So overall, I think it's a well-funded plan. I think it's a plan kind of at the legislature that is kind of moves along without a lot of politics. The politics are really at the teacher's plan and the other big state plan. This one just goes along and does its thing without a lot of political interference, which is good. Important considerations is TMRS basically said, consider this to be an irrevocable decision. I don't think technically it's an irrevocable decision, but if you get the staff into this for 10 years and then all of a sudden you decide, no, we want to go back to the DC plan, I don't know exactly how that would be done. So you should just go into this with the mindset of this is what we want to do, not thinking of it as a decision that we're going to try it for a couple years and then get out of it. All participating cities, including DPFP, would be required to fund 100% of the actuarially determined contribution on an annual basis. That's what sets the plan's contribution rate. It's not a fixed number. And
you want to move ahead?
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm moving too many things. Thank you. Appreciate that. And just like the DPFP plan and any plan, there's risk associated with that. So an actuarial evaluation will be done on an annual basis for our plan. We're starting with, zero liability because we have no retirees. So we have no unfunded liability, so that's helpful. But we are, you'd be subject to investment risk, people live longer, raises, all that. The same risk of the big DPFP plan would impact the TMRS plan. Just important to understand that. Those risks already exist. Right now, though, the employee bears them all in the DC plan. So the way that TMRS works is a little bit different than we thought when we first talked about this. So I originally thought the employee puts in a percentage, and then the system would put in 1.5 or 2 times that percentage. That's not exactly how it works, and that's because on the employer side, you have to contribute at the actuarially determined contribution amount. So I wanted to go through how this works. So, and I'll talk about the costs and the options as we go forward. But basically, an employee contributes a set percentage of their compensation each pay period, and that money goes into an account in their name. On an annual basis, account gets interest. It gets interest at December 31st based on your January 1 balance. So when we start in the plan, everybody's going to have zero. So the first year you get zero. So the interest is always a lag. But right now it's statutorily set at 5%. And those employee contributions plus the interest is the employee's balance. So when they get a statement at the end of each year, it's just going to show that. It shows nothing from the city, nothing from DPFP as a employer contribution. That's probably going to be a little bit of a surprise to some of our employees. We've talked about it, but they're used to seeing their DC balance. That's a communication issue that we'll have to make them understand that. This next bullet, I have an error in it, and I'll explain that. So DPFP will make its contributions on a monthly basis into TMRS. That money goes into an account. That account earns interest, and at the last minute, I put in 5%. It's not 5% interest. The interest that's earned on the employer account is the earnings that the fund made for that year. So I apologize for the 5%. So it's whatever the fund makes from TMRS, that's what goes into the employer's account. So it could be negative, could be higher than 5%. It just is what it is, and that's where the investment risk comes in.
Is that the combination of the employee and employer account, or only the employer?
Only the employer.
Only the employer.
So the employee account is there. It's either 5%, 6%, or 7%, whatever you guys, the board elects to put in there. And the interest is set at statutorily 5%. And that could change if the statute changes. So as I mentioned a couple times, the employer contribution rate will change on an annual basis. The way they do it is they try to keep it so it doesn't change a lot based on their actuarial numbers, but you should expect that it fluctuates a little bit. And then when an employee retires is when they actually see the benefit of the system's money going into that account.
So Kelly, would you just say kind of in your most plain words, the contribution by the employer varies based upon what deliverable, like what is the equation solving for that would cause that to change over time?
So the what causes that to change is on an annual basis, the TMRS actuary will do an actuarial evaluation on our little staff plan over at TMRS. And depending on how that changed based on our demographics or pay increases or investment returns, those types of things, that will change the actuarially determined contribution rate, and that's what will change.
But it's solving for a defined benefit based upon, so it's starting with a defined benefit, and you overlay on that the assumptions on how people will live and all those other actuarial things, and then ultimately you solve for what the employer match ought to be.
Right, but just to clarify, and I have this a little bit, the defined benefit that it's solving for is not the similar defined benefit that we have. It's more of the employee's contribution amount times the multiplier. It's not years of service times the multiplier times your average comp, like our DB plan is. It's really, it's basically, are they doubling what is in the employee's account? Are they one and a half? It, or are they giving you one time? I have a little more information on that.
Can that change over time?
Yes, you can change that over time.
Right now we're paying, what, two times in versus the employee?
I have a chart on that.
Okay.
So so just as, you know, the employees are going to see as they go through their career here, their contributions going in, and then interest that comes in a year lag, and that's all they'll see on their statement. If they meet retirement eligibility and they go to retire, they will get the city's match or the DPFP match that is being held in this account. And this slide, the next slide, shows how the benefit is calculated. These words are a little bit different than the words we use, but that's because I took them out of the TMRS handbook, and I didn't want to deviate. So just to say what I just said, right now in the DPFP system for the members, their benefit is years of service times the multiplier times average comp. The TMRS benefit is based on your account balance plus interest plus a match from the employer, which is the second bullet, the matching funds and other credits I'll explain the other credits in a moment. And then they take whatever that those two balances are together, and they look at your life expectancy, the life expectancy of your beneficiary if you select one, and the payment plan you elect, and then they come up with an actuarial calculation or a calculation and come up with your annuity based on that. So that part's very similar to kind of how our drop works, in the fact you have a balance and they allocate that to you in an annuity over your life expectancy. It gets a little more complicated here because you can have your survivor built in there, but that's really how it works. Questions about that?
Kelly, do the employees, I know they don't see it on their statement, but do they know what the match is? I mean, can they check and see what the match is along the way?
They don't see it on their statement, but they can, on the TMRS website, go in and see the plan provisions, so they would see whatever match is, but they can also run a benefit estimate. So they can, at any time, go in and click what their benefit would be, and that's where you would see the match and the other credits coming in. So they will see it that way.
Okay.
And then, once again, back to the question I asked before, I get the concept of that when you retire, you have a total amount, and that gets annuitized.
Right.
Okay. But the total amount is the employer match every year solving for some pathway to an estimated total amount. So is that where the variability kicks in or not? I'm trying to understand what triggers the variability on the employer match as projections turn into reality over the course of time.
So there isn't a specific dollar benefit that's guaranteed.
Okay.
What is guaranteed is that you will have a specific percentage match. Let's, for conversations, let's say 2 times. So the guarantee is if I put in we can just go to that chart. It might make it easier. I just went to slide 13 for those of you looking. So let's just look at the last column to talk about this. So if the employee put in 7%, that is a 2-to-1 match. And that would mean that the GPFP match that benefits the employee is 14%. However, the cost of that 14% for DPFP is on that third line from the bottom. It's 9.44%. And the reason for that differential is because it doesn't cost DPFP 14% to pay 14%, because you're going to put the money in now, and over time it's going to earn interest earnings just like our plan. And based on the TMRS investing their investments in the market.
The 6.75%.
Yes, basically. If they
do better,
we pay less. Right, if they do better, we pay less. If as the market swings, just like DPFP, it goes up and down. The other thing that it can impact that 9.44% is, let's say we cut our staff in half. Well, then that rate would probably go up. Or we hire double the number of people, that rate would go down. People live longer. That rate could go up. I mean, but they have all of these actuarial assumptions built into that 9.44. That number is determined on an annual basis by GRS, their actuary, based on our population and expected changes over time.
If it goes negative, this becomes beyond the 14%.
If the if we have a 2008, then
the TMRS. Has like a down 5%. What happens then? What do we pay?
I can't tell you that specifically. I'm not an actuary.
Yeah, I
know
what
you mean.
It's again,
is it capped off at 14? Is what I'm saying.
No, there's no cap. There's no cap. So it real. I mean, so really, what you're doing here is right now the employees have all the risk because they're in a DC plan. The market goes down. They take all the risk. This is shifting the risk to the employer side, which is, I think, the point. To be able to have a guaranteed stream of payments, you have to come up with something here. But right now, the risk of market swings is all on the employee, which is not what happens in Social Security. It's not what happens in a DB plan. So this is kind of moderating that.
But the employer risk is an annual change in the contribution requirement, not a big one-time hit or anything like that. You're doing that gradually over 30 years or
right.
30 years or whatever that number would be.
Right. This is a calculation that they've done assuming actuarial assumptions of, I think it's a 20-year funding level, a 2.75 salary increase, very similar to the assumptions we do when we make our the DPFP actuarial evaluation. This is no different than the DPFP valuation. What is different here is the city contributes a flat amount and not the actuarially determined contribution.
When you say the city, you mean our system.
When I compare the difference,
okay.
So let me say something, and I mean it as a question.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I heard you say is that in order to have something that ultimately looks like a 2X match using your 7%, that is a number that, based upon investment returns, the amount that we contribute would grow into that. So under these assumptions right now, you would put in 9.3%, that would then grow to 14% over a period of time. Is that correct, generally?
It would fund a benefit equal to 14%.
So another way to think about it, if market returns from this point forward were zero,
mm-hmm.
okay, not a loss, not a gain, but zero, then you would fund exactly 14%, 9.3%.
If all other assumptions were
right
on.
I think that you have a big thought of oh my gosh, the risk has gone from the employee to the employer, but I think we have to apply a fair amount of common sense that risk would be based upon and that the market returns close to zero from here on out on a diversified basis,
right.
Which has implications for America, and all that kind of stuff, and capital gets no return, and that where we are right now is that just the 14, right?
Right now we're paying 12, which is the first column. But
okay. All right, so if we were at the 12, so we move over to the left one, and we're contributing 7.98, market returns would have to be zero, and that would have to be baked into the assumptions in order for us to be equal in terms of how much we pay out now versus what we pay out under TMRS. Is that true?
I think so. I'm not an actuary. I mean, that makes sense to me because right now in the first column we're paying 12 and getting 12. So if there is no investment return,
so
it has to be 5, Kelly, because then the investment return would match the interest credited, and then it would be equal.
It's a little different because
benefit for me and a TMRS person.
It is actually different because there is the other thing that gets built in is the whole life expectancy issue. So I guess the answer is no. It's not exactly right. But
in terms of the largest impact, because that to me makes me feel a heck of a lot more comfortable about the whole concept of who's bearing the risk. We're bearing the risk, and there are no market returns to be achieved, given the fact that they historically have achieved 6.75%. This won't be our only problem if that's the reality.
But it's also, let me exacerbate this on a theoretical, if you could understand, it's a double whammy, right? Because if this fund is not achieving that, then our fund isn't achieving that, and that's where this pool of capital is coming from. It's not like this instrument, like it's not this bottomless pit. It is not the city where we can get, there are other sources or maybe ways in which that funding can happen. We're limited. We're limited to our pension system. And I'm for this, but I just want to understand this in that respect.
Right.
So let me give a little bit of historical context. First, I think one thing that's not on here, the assumed rate for TMRS right now is 6.75%. It's pretty, they're conservatively managed, and actually about a dozen years ago, the legislature changed their statute. They were, up until 2000, mid-late 2000s, they only could invest in fixed income. They had nothing else but fixed income. And they got a legislative change to change that. And I think, I'm not sure that they're still totally allocated to their ultimate allocation to equities and real estate and private equity and that kind of thing. They're still, I think they're still making their way there. And it is, from my non-investment view, it's a very, you know, they have that history behind it. It's a very conservatively managed fund in the sense of, you know, sort of where they're going to go in the future, 20, 30 years from now, I think. They're not at all, I mean, well, I'm not going to say that.
Well, if they want to take some risks, we maybe have some suggestions.
But I think
it's so
Again,
Who would be the ultimate guarantor then? I mean, obviously we're the first guarantor of the benefit. But if we had an inability to do that, would they be the guarantor of that benefit?
No. So what you would do is, let's say you picked the 7 and the 2 times, and it got too expensive for the system. You could go to 7 and 1.5, or you could go to 6 and 1. And I mean, you could change those. The employee and the employer match amounts to help with that situation. The other thing you could do is, if you look at the bottom line, if the board chooses the 6 and the 2, which actually is a decrease for the total going into the employee's account by 0.5%. But if you choose the 6 and the 2, it saves the system, based on 2022 salaries, $126,000. Just in next year alone. And if you pick the 7 and 2 times, it saves $84,000. You could pre-fund that. You could take that savings this year in 2022 and give it to TMRF, which lessens your risk in the future. It would lower
I like the way you're thinking. That, to me, is a little bit, because it also is fair in the sense that we're normalizing the salary on the benefits. And you can argue anyway. Because, you know, it's sort of like, if people view that the salaries were based on a benefit in the back end, then that's an easier argument to have. That okay, we're decreasing it. That's a savings, but I agree that we should just fund it. It's just prudent to do that. That's complicated to explain, but
well, right now, if we do nothing, the current plan has you putting in 12% or $378,000. If we go to TMRS, it's 251 or 293, depending on what you do.
It's sort of like, I know what you're saying, that we're paying for this, and so it's the same amount, but it's a different benefit, right? And so, and we're now liable for it, and that liability needs to be reflected on how much we contribute initially. So it's not just really how much we're paying; it really should reflect the liability going forward. Let me leave it at that. But I'm just thinking. This is just new information, and I'm just thinking of how.
Yeah, there's nothing that stops you from over-contributing.
Right.
So you take that savings, contribute, and you're building a cushion for the future.
Exactly.
That would make sense.
And it would make sense to me, because then it's a more conservative initially, and you're working into it as well. And it's a little bit more, and it's, yeah.
Are there more questions on this, or should I hit some points that I've skipped?
Said something about a credit.
There is. I will get to the credit, but since that's optional, let me talk about a couple other.
Kelly, what about the 5-year vesting for existing employees?
Good question. Thank you. Let me go back to that.
I don't know why.
John, can you go to... slide. Here we go. So on slide 9, that doesn't seem right. Hold on. Can't read it. Oh, slide 34 or 9 on the presentation. This talks about the plan features that are not optional to the board. The first two used to be options to the board where you had a choice. You no longer have a choice on this. But on the vesting in particular, it's a 5-year vesting schedule. And the time served with DPFP prior to joining DPFP counts towards vesting. It doesn't at all count impact your benefit calculations, but it does count towards vesting. So all but four current employees have been here more than 5 years, and so they would be vested when they go into TMRS, which means if they were to leave immediately, they wouldn't lose any of their employer match, but if they left immediately, there'd be zero or 1 year of payments and 1 year of match or whatever. So that's what that means. The retirement that once you have been vested or 5 years of service and you're age 60, you're eligible to retire, or once you have 20 years of service, you are eligible to retire at any age. And I believe there's currently five employees that are close to that that are either already eligible because of age or years of service. If you leave DPFP prior to vesting, you receive your contributions back and your interest, but you do not receive the DPFP match.
Does the DPFP contribution stay in the plan? So if, like, someone leaves, you guys might have to fund less in a future year. We might have to fund less in a future year because we've already funded for someone that left.
Yes. It does give the exactly. It stays there. If there is a disability option, it doesn't give you more in a benefit, but what it does do is allows you to get the city's match if you are determined to be disabled and you haven't met the retirement eligibility piece. You're able to get those contributions. This next page are plan features that are still not optional, and these are factors that impact the retiree annuity calculation. So it's based on the life expectancy of the member and any survivor if that's elected by the member. That life expectancy is determined by the TMRS actuary. And
couldn't we get these numbers before we do?
What numbers?
The actuarial numbers and the schematics. I mean, the whole, like, what currently what the staff and what that would mean and what that would cost.
The 9.44% is what it would cost, right, currently. And I can give you the TMRS actuarial valuation if you'd like. And
could ask the same question. Let's assume market returns were 6.75 every year, mm-hmm, into perpetuity. Would the cost change from the 9.44 at all, other than potentially some modest tweaks for experience of how long people live and things like that?
It would stay 9.44% if all the other assumptions remain the same.
Yeah.
So if you met the life expectancy.
So there's no lost leader or anything like that.
No.
In this. I think it's important that you have the headline risk shift, but when you really look into the details, there's tons of mitigants here.
Okay.
And in kind of my sense of it, and I also like the fact that this is a conservative plan that has a lot of history to it, that, you know, appears to have been prudently managed, and all those things feel good, because there is, you know, the dollar impact is one thing, but there's a sensitivity issue because, you know, we exist to provide benefits, and then here we are, you know, providing benefits for staff through an alternative vehicle, and so that creates tremendous sensitivity. We all understand that. But I think that staff's done a good job, great job, of thinking through this and presenting something that hopefully works for all sides.
Again, it's not, you know, two things. One, you have to question why is our staff one of the few that don't have this plan? Okay? And two, you have to understand that they did have the feature this way and it changed. And why did it change? So if we're just, and when you go back and see all that, you don't have a problem making it right, going back to what is appropriate. But just understand, I know TMRS from even before, and I know that it's been always prudently managed, and for the size, it's done really well. So it's just a matter of this is, and the shift in liability onto the city, the pension system. And then moving forward, And there are things that you can make, we can decide, make it a little bit more palpable for maybe the entire member because it's sensitivity of the ship. That's all.
So just to talk about this briefly, because I do think that the payment options are really the really important benefit for the employee and what we're really trying to achieve with this. So at the end of the day, when someone goes to retire, they have their pool of money. It's matched however the board decides it gets matched. That money is then turned into an annuity based on your life expectancy and a future interest crediting rate, which is currently 5%, because you're not going to get all your money paid out immediately. So that's how the annuity is based. It's also impacted by the payment options. So you can choose to have, I want a stream of payments for me, for my life expectancy only, or there's three options for survivor benefits. There's survivor benefits that have a guarantee, so at least 5 years of payments for the retiree, 10, 15. There's also a lump sum option. It's a small amount, one, two, or three years, I think, with some maximums that you can take as a lump sum, and then your remaining balance is annuitized. So these payment options, the lifetime stream is what we're trying to achieve. Whether that's a big stream or a little stream will depend on how big your pool is when you get there. So here are the plan options that are your choices. So I've talked about this before. It's how much does the employee put in? The three choices you have are 5%, 6%, 7%. Currently, employees are putting in 6.5%. You would get to choose your match. Are you going to put in a one-to-one match, a 1.5-to-1 match, or a 2-to-1 match?
And right now we're putting in 12%?
Right now you're putting in 12%, and we'll go back to that chart, which is actually a 1.85% match to the
6.5%.
Yep. And there's also a choice of the supplemental death benefit, which is available for active and retirees, and I'll explain that on the next slide. So the supplemental benefit, most TMRS employers offer this, and that statement is taken from their actuarial evaluation. What this benefit does is if an employee dies while they're in active service, they get a death benefit equal to approximately 1 year's pay. If they die after retirement, it's $7,500 to a beneficiary. The total cost for all employees on an annual basis based on 2022 numbers is about $4,100. So that seems like a good benefit for a little bit of money. So now we're back to this chart with the numbers. So the first slot, the first column again, is our current plan. Employee puts in 6.5, and the DPFP match is 1.85. 1.85 is not an option. It's either 1.5 or 2. And then, you know, the DPFP match is 12. So total contributions right now going into employees' defined contribution is 18.5. If we go with the option of 6% employee 2x match, that gets us the closest, but it is a slight decline from what is going into the current DC plan. So that would get us to 18%. That cost the system 7.98%, and then that supplemental death benefits of 0.13%, so a total of 8.11% if you want to do that. Again, that's a savings of $126,000 over where we are. If you don't want the employees to have less into their account than they currently have in the DC, it would be the employee contribution rate of 7, a two times match or 14%, and that's a 21% increase or 21% benefit basically. So that's an increase in a benefit, but it costs the system less to get there. Question. It's a lot of numbers.
I mean, one question. Have you discussed this at all with the employee group? I mean, is there any overall view? Is this favorable? I mean, I can see from the system of being able to attract employees, this makes sense. And having a secure pension fund makes sense. It should make sense for employees. But have you gotten any feedback?
We have talked to employees about this on several occasions. Some employees are ecstatic about it. They think it's really great. One employee in particular thinks they will leave the system if they don't have some guaranteed benefit. This is a very good employee. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. Some people are ecstatic. Some people are weary. No, well, some people are, I would say,
they think it's a good thing. They're just not jumping, you know, they're not as happy as the one people, I think, that really understand it more. There's one employee that's a little more, I think, leery about it. But overall, it's only one employee that has really expressed any concern to me about it. Everybody else, is that a fair statement? Do you all, have you heard anything else?
I have not.
Okay, so one out of 25 may have a concern about it.
I would say so, but I guess I have to say I'm not sure everybody's telling me their concerns. They might not understand it fully.
Right.
So I don't want to say everybody's happy with it. But I haven't heard a lot of negative.
Okay.
I don't want to overrepresent the positive.
If we say the match is 2, is that regardless whether the employee does 5, 6, or 7?
No. You get to pick what the employee does.
Okay,
so
we pick. That's not a choice. Okay.
Right, they don't get to pick that. The board would set that.
Okay, so let's go on.
Okay, so a couple of times I talked about employer match and other credits. There's 2 other credits primarily that are options. I'm not recommending either of them today. I might recommend the updated service credit in November, but I don't have the dollars yet. So the 2 credits that the board could offer are this updated service credit and a COLA. I'm not recommending the COLA. But I wanted to let you know that that is an option, and my guess is when we get the specific language, you might have to do that. Both of these credits are credits that the board can do on an annual basis, or you can do it as a repeating election. So you elect it once, and it's for every year. The COLA, by the way, 71% of the people in TMRS actually have the COLA, but I am not recommending the COLA at this time. It could be added in the future if the future board ever wants to do that. The updated service credit is very popular with TMRS. 67% of the plans have it, but that covers 91% of the members. I'll try to explain the updated service credit. It's the most complicated feature of TMRS. What it does is basically what the DPFP member plan does. So let me explain how that works. I'm talking about our regular plan.
Our plan.
For our members, the police and fire. So when a police or fire goes to retire, their benefit is calculated based on their highest 3 or 5 years of service, right? Over their career, they have been contributing as a new police recruit and then as a police officer. So they were contributing on their actual lower salary throughout their entire 20 years before they go to retire. But it's the last 5 years they get this calculated into their payment. What the updated service credit does is it does that same thing in addition to something else. But let's talk about that same thing. So what the updated service credit would do is for TMRS, is the employee would still put in their percentage match, or I mean their percentage contribution, and nothing changes. But when that system match is calculated at retirement, it would assume for their career, their pay was based on that highest 3 years of service, just like the DPFP plan does and most retirement plans. Does that make sense? It is the most complicated piece.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. The question is, do we want it or not?
Right. And so, and that can be done at a 50, 75, or 100%. I don't know exactly how that would work. One thing to keep in mind about the updated service credit is it has no impact, and you can't even really do it for 4 years, for more than 4 years, because you have to have 3 years of service plus an actuarial study that has to be done 13 months before. So you're talking has no impact, can't be done for 5 years. But if the board wants to do it, it's a future cost, so you might want to start funding it now. I mean, that's the actuarially prudent thing to do. But you don't have to. You could do that later down the road. You're just, it's something that would cost money.
Yeah. Do they bake it into that 9?
Yes, if you selected it. And it is one of the more expensive things. So I don't know the cost yet, but I'll have it in the next one. But it is something you could
So you would come back, let's just say under all the other those other assumptions, it was at 9.1%. You'd say it's 8.8 if you don't do it, it's 9.1 if you do, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's not a cheap thing. It's not as cheap as the supplemental benefit. I think it's a big dollar amount. But if you think you want to do it in the future, you might want to start funding it sooner.
Sure.
I wanted you to know about that because that is an option. Any questions about that? Okay, good. That's the hardest one.
I'm still not totally.
On the updated service credit? Or the, so basically, if a police officer retires, only their last years of service are calculated
right.
in their benefit. That's exactly what this does.
Okay.
The other thing that this would do, because I said there was a couple others, if let's say you started the plan at a 6%, or let's say a 6% employee contribution and a 7%, and then later you went to 7%, the updated service credit would assume you always had the 7 in its calculating of the system match. So it basically kind of trues up everything to the last. But it's not cheap because of that.
My reaction is you want to probably try to make this change and keep it relatively simple at this stage.
Exactly. I mean,
you've got the
option
3 or 4 years down the road. You can always consider it then.
And you also gain it, right? If that's the case. You go throughout 6, and then toward the last 5, you do 7, right?
What's the board would do it? The board, that's a board contribution.
Okay.
That the board does it, makes the decision on the employee contribution.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the whole, all my slides, apparently.
So what are you looking at today? Are you looking just for our feedback? Or?
I'm looking for your feedback. Would you like me to bring someone in from TMRS? Do you have specific questions that I wasn't able to answer today?
I think this is the right approach, clearly, from a system standpoint and an employee standpoint. So I think we should, but I think it's prudent in a big decision that we probably should have somebody come in just to go over the big picture with us at the next meeting or you know, whenever we have to make this decision.
Okay,
I don't know what the time frame is, but it's prudent for this kind of a change to have them come in and explain it in a little more detail.
Okay.
I don't know.
Hey, Kelly, it's Armando. Hey, Kelly, can you hear me?
Yes.
So one question I have, and it's really not a question, more along the lines of a suggestion. To Bill's point, to Nick's point, to Tina's point, this is a big decision for the board, right? And I believe to give it its proper formatting, whatever, however you want to phrase it, can we have a special meeting with that TMRS person? Or we can just focus on this one issue and just get down in the weeds on it and not making a normal board agenda item. I just want to give it the attention that it deserves. Any thoughts on that?
I'm fine with that. It's really up to Nick.
I mean, my default and preference always would be not to do something like that. I mean, we're talking about something that is, from an expense item, I think about $200,000 a year. Now, I think we're all aware, and maybe we think about it to varying degrees, that there's a perception issue here that weighs more heavily than $200,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so I would prefer that we all focus and sort of serve up any issues or things that we want to have answered and come into the next month's meeting prepared to be ultimately decisive. Now, and that's why I think, you know, Kelly and staff have done a very good job of kind of teeing this up today. And if ultimately that's where it gets to, you know, we can do that, but I really would prefer that we deal with it the appropriate thing that it is, which is, you know, a couple $200, it's significant dollars, but it's
not dollar magnitude the most significant thing that we're doing or giving advice or consent on. So in my mind, it does not rise to that need based upon what I see and know right now. But in order to be decisive, I would encourage all of us to serve up issues we have and to, you know, go back and reread this, send Kelly any questions so that she can come in next month with properly resourced so that we can make a decision.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's not a huge line item issue from a monetary standpoint. Perception, yeah, it is. But is it the right thing to do? Yes. But throughout the presentation, there were just two or three different times where I heard, I don't have that information, but I'll get it to you by next month. I'll bring in the person to explain this a little bit better next month. I just want to make sure that this topic gets the attention that it deserves and that we're able to dig down into it. So the sooner we can get all those lingering questions answered, I think everybody will be able to get to a point of being decisive. I'm in favor of it. I just want to make sure that it gets the attention that it deserves. Thank you.
Armando, the one thing to think about, too, is I do think it's important to make a decision sooner rather than later, but there is no if we're not able to make a decision at the next month and you need more information, we could make it in December. If you need more information in December, we can make it in January. It's not that we have to make a decision to meet some 12/31 year end or something like that.
Okay.
We have been working on it for a couple of years, so I don't want it to drag out forever. But if we can get the most of the questions answered before the next meeting and during the next meeting, I think we'll be in a good place.
But if we can go back
right
to the slide and have the cost on it.
And from, an employee standpoint also, you know, you dangle this carrot out there, and I don't want it lingering too long over their heads. We need to make a decision and move on. I just want to make sure we have all the information that we need and give, again, give the topic the time and attention that it deserves.
Yeah, but going back to this chart, right now the we're doing a 2x match, right?
A 1.85.
A 1.85. What do the employees on average contribute?
6.5%.
So that for everyone, or is it?
Everybody puts.
Okay, so 6.5 and 1.85 is the as is into this defined contribution plan.
Correct.
Yeah, and so what we're talking about is now opting into a defined benefit plan that if we just use the far right hand of 7 and the 2X, under the assumptions that Kelly has outlined, and assuming we have 6.75% average returns going forward, it has a cost of $293,000 under that, and that is $84,000-$85,000 less than what we have this year. I think what Kelly outlined in terms of things that may affect are number-wise modestly small things that she wasn't completely up to speed on, like the cost of this thing where you get the years added.
Yeah, right.
And other things like that. But in terms of the bulk of what this is, I think these are the numbers that speak to it, and understanding that largely deviations in market returns are going to be the things that would cause that 9.44% versus the 14, which would be the 2x multiplier to adjust, and that's the bulk of it. And the other things are not immaterial, but they're not as significant as these core numbers. So I would encourage all of us to kind of, you know, try to get, as I'm struggling and, you know, I think Kelly's doing a good job of getting us around, arms around it, because, you know, I'm not directly connected to the police or fire and the beneficiaries, I maybe don't possess all the sensitivities that, some of the rest of you bring to the table in terms of sensitivities that people will have. And I guess what I'm saying is let's bring those all to the table. Let's, you know, surface them up. And my bias is let's bring this to a decision in the next meeting.
I guess two questions. One is I'd say my bias is towards the six and the two. One is giving the employee, we're not forcing the employees to put more in than they are today, and it's keeping our cost at the same level that it is today. So I think perception-wise, that would be it, that we should.
We can discuss this in closed session. We can discuss it in open session. But I have a suggestion.
Okay. I mean, whatever. That would be my suggestion, is that we don't force employees to put in more than they are today.
I think most of the employees.
You say that statement, but you're saying that statement when the legislature just did that to the members of CFPB. You've got to be careful about that because they're now spending 13 and a half. So a lot of these guys wouldn't like to do that either. So you got to be careful about what saying that. This is not a DuPont PC. This is a, you know, this is a benefit plan, and I think it's not one for one. I think you have to consider that there's a shift in liability. And that, yes, it's less now, but it will be graduating as we go along. So, like, it shouldn't be considered like, okay, this is $1, this is another dollar. It's $1 for a different type of
But we also
money.
Don't want to increase our costs either.
That's what I'm saying. But, like, that's exactly what I'm saying. So we have to be, there's a way to do this to make it palpable and make it a little bit more fair.
Well, both of these options lower the system's cost under the actuarial assumptions in place now. I can't tell you what the future is going to hold, but even though the end value to the member, the employee is higher, doesn't cost the system more than you're paying today. I have not polled the staff, I will admit, on if they'd rather do six or seven. I assume, and I'm probably wrong in this, that most employees would feel like going from 6.5 down to only putting away six is a takeaway. But maybe they're not. Maybe they would like to put in less. I don't know. I can poll them and see.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's
if they would rather have more coming out of their check or less coming out of their check.
Okay, and you have to remember this is part of a whole package of compensation. And if we have said that the compensation reflected a DC plan, not this type of plan, then it has to be normalized a little bit. I'm just saying it can be changed later on, but initially it has to be earned. You've got to go toward it. It's not the city of Dallas. It is the system. The system is in trouble. I'm just trying to keep that in mind. I'm not saying I'm not against it. I'm just saying that where we get for the staff is great. I think we're in the right direction. But
which would argue for a lower contribution from us if we're worried about the system's viability. But it's a relatively small number.
Yeah, and I guess...
That can change with health.
It can change, but the magnitude is still going to be relatively immaterial. Whether it changes from 200,000 to 300,000 is a big jump, but it's a small number in the big picture.
Okay, I guess what I'm suggesting is that we surface all these issues. If we're at a point where a month from now we're deliberating six versus seven, then I hope that means that we've kind of worked our way through all the other issues here. And that I think this is an incredibly viable direction to go. And staff's done a lot of work on it. I think they've been incredibly sensitive to the perception issue. And I think it's incumbent on us to think, can we look at the membership, you know, in the eyes and say that we're fully behind the adoption of this, however we ultimately will come out on it, and we feel good about it, and we feel like we can look them right in the eye and tell them why we think this is the right thing to do. And so let's surface any issues between now and then. I think there is some amount of additional data, but I don't think a lot. To be done, so we can't kind of go there and say there's one little, we need to surface it up. And my strong bias is to bring this to a decision next month.
Well, one last question, just timing. Is there a thing that we have to go in on July 1, or, I mean, we can go in any month?
You can go in any month. They basically, once we give them the notice of participation, it's effective the next month.
Okay.
As long as they can administratively handle it.
Okay. Well, next month, I thought we were going to have the ability to, from some of the money from the system to come in the stock house.
They are.
Yeah.
And then we decide.
Sure.
Yeah, if possible, I'd like to do that all in one meeting.
Okay.
If not, we can push it if there's a good, just reason. But my judgment tells me we can bring this to a decision, and I think we should.
Yeah, and Nick, to your point that you made just a minute ago, the sooner we get this done, the better off it's going to be for the employees and the system as a whole, because one of the things that Kelly touched on was the ability to cast a broader net when recruiting and retaining people, right? If you know, we have some positions that are open that she could be able to reach out to other people, other cities within Texas that may be interested in moving over. So I don't want us to lose sight of that either.
I agree with that, Armando.
But let me be clear. In my question, next month we will agree on allowing it and the rate, or just allowing it?
I think that what I would suggest is that people serve up to Kelly through email, whatever. These are the areas I would like further data or clarification. Kelly has already said there's one or two more items, like the cost of that year's plan. Right.
Right.
Yeah, that she has provided. And was there one other thing?
Well, so there's a specific set of elections and wording that needs to be in the motion that the board adopts when you choose to participate. So if you're going to choose to participate, two of those are what is the employee contribution, what is the match. So that goes together. But you'll see that, and I don't have the wording of that.
Okay, so but that'll be served up before the meeting, so people will have a chance to see it. We serve up whatever things we want further clarification. We bring in a resource that from TMRS who can speak to it. That becomes part of the agenda, and that, you know, we look to come up with a decision or non-decision, but we take some action or inaction proactively.
what is it, inaction proactively?
Inaction would be the question that we didn't think about.
I guess we decide, man, I'm saying decide not to decide. How's that?
Do a lot of that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else on this, the proposed?
If we're going to have a vote on next month, then I'd like to see more variables on this sheet, and I can talk and I can ask online.
Let me know what you want, because I can provide whatever information that's an available option for the board.
Hey, Kelly, one of the questions I've already been asked is, how does this compare to the DPFP plan? Can you provide that? Maybe I can get you some data points.
Well, I mean, it's a whole different plan. I know that a specific member keeps asking that question. You know, the DPFP benefit is years of service times the multiplier times your average comp. That's not what this is. This is you have a pool of money and that gets annuitized. I don't know how to compare those two. They're just, it's an apple and orange.
That's what I was thinking, apples and oranges.
So but I think that's a very good point that needs to be delineated. So when the members hear this, it's not a percentage of their income for the last 5 years. Okay, I know that sounds, we understand that, but I think that's where the confusion is. They think that is some guaranteed percentage of your income going forward as opposed to this annuity type structure. At some point, something as simple as that, I believe, is being misconstrued.
Right. I mean, it's hard. And it's also kind of irrelevant because the members can't,
staff can't get into DPFE plan, and DPFE plan can't get into TMRS, so it's kind of an irrelevant conversation. But I know
I agree.
One person keeps asking that question.
Okay.
Ready?
All right. Someone just said we made progress on this, so let's move on.
Okay. So the next item, I'll do the next item quickly since I'm eating into the investment time, which I apologize for. So the monthly contribution report is very similar to the prior months. It is on page, every time I click on this, I can't see the page number, 109 of your PDF for diligence. This is the October report, includes August data. There's no real changes from the prior month. They are down 170 people. Fire is over by 41 people. Police is down 211 people. I think that's just a timing issue with all of the retirements that happened last month. The city did approve pretty significant raises that just went into effect that will help our contributions going forward, but they are on track and really the same percentages as the prior month. Any questions about the contribution report? Okay. The next item is the monthly board approval of the trustee education and travel. John, my clicker doesn't seem to want to work today. You go to that item. That's page 114 of your materials. There, Carol went ahead and added a lot of classes for TechSpers and NCPers on this for your forward planning. If you're interested in attending these, please let us know. But right now, there's no motion that needs to be made on this.
Is there any, do any of us have any of those scheduled mandatory classes we have to take, the online ones?
I will answer that question during the executive director's report because Carol.
Hello?
Did it drop?
Yeah. I think it dropped. Yeah, I think they kicked
me
out.
Yeah, it dropped for me, too.
They got mad at me, and they kicked me out.
Yeah, me too, Armando.
Well,
stirring the pot a little too much this morning.
This is Gilbert. I was kicked out earlier, and I had to call back in.
So is that what we need
this
to
call back in? This time, they must have cut off. So why don't we all just wait a few minutes?
Yeah,
okay.
I just sent Kelly a text message.
Good. Thank you, Armando.
Okay. Hopefully everybody's back. I'm sorry about losing you there. Nick had asked a question right before I think the trustees got kicked off the phone about anybody needing continuing education. And actually everybody is current on their continuing education, and Carol sends information out on that. The next person that is up that has anything due, it's not due till June of 2022, so you're all good for at least 8 months.
Got it.
You're all good. Thank you for that.
All right, Ryan.
All right. First investment item we have is a recap of the September 23rd ISC meeting. Two main topics we covered there was the international small cap search. We talked about the six managers that we're down to for semifinalists to issue the RFP process, steps going forward. IAC was in concurrence with the managers we selected and issuing the RFP. We issued it at the end of September. The deadline for responses is today. We've gotten two in so far, so they got some extra credit. We should have the rest of them rolling in today. Plan to bring, hope to be able to bring finalists back for IAC to review in December at that meeting.
Is the IAC fully staffed?
Yes,
okay.
Fully staffed. And the way the quorum works, if someone from the outside can't attend, it creates an issue. But so we've been two in a row. We've had full quorum.
Great.
What are their next terms up?
There's two outside members with Cash and Bill Velasco, whose terms are up at the end of December. So we're going to reach out to them to see if they want to stay on. If they do, then the board will have to reappoint them to one of the next two meetings. And if not, we'll need to find an additional outside member.
Now, was Boston Partners one of the people getting the small cap thing or not?
No.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a
Yeah, so the other item we talked about, the IAC, was the public equity structure study, which looks at with the higher allocation based on the recent asset allocation to equity, how do we want to allocate within that 60% between global and EM. IAC was in concurrence with the allocation targets we outlined. They had a question on Boston Partners. They look different than the other four global managers because they have more small and mid-cap exposure, and they've been underweight to the U.S. for, you know, three-plus years now.
Quite a significant amount. I mean,
yeah.
Not just underweight, but a
So we're going to talk a lot more detail about them as part of Greg's presentation, and then Makita's bringing the structure review today to the meeting, so we have some answers. There'll be some questions on them, but
okay.
As a follow-up item, the IAC asked to look at their attribution by country for the last 3 years, so we're bringing that back to look at in more detail in December.
Okay.
Gilbert, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think you've covered it. You know, we're in a good rhythm now, and I anticipate the two members that are coming due to want to stay on, but we'll report back.
All right. Thanks, Gilbert. John, you get the clicker ready, or do you just want to? We'll move on to the portfolio update next. Precisely. All right, start with the executive summary of the investment portfolio. We've received $149 million in private market distributions year to date. That, you know, as you guys know, it's been the top focus. That is. So about 20% of the private asset portfolio has been sold off this year. Later in the agenda, we're going to do the quarterly review of the private assets activity, so we'll go through that in more detail. We're expecting about another 30 in distributions through year end. On the rebalancing front, we've redeployed $90 million into public markets so far this year, mostly in the second half once asset allocation was approved. We are planning on doing about another $70 million by year end. So we'll probably have another action at the end of October here. Brenda mentioned we received the final outstanding audit for the final outstanding audit from Hub Energy. We saw a $15 million write down there with this updated value. And then on Lone Star, we booked the internal write downs this month. So we're no longer showing the adjusted private market number. It's just one number until there's another COVID. Something else, but hopefully we don't have to go back to adjusting anything on the private market side. Simplifies the reporting a little bit. And then I have the note here on the small cap that we just covered. Okay, so we have a couple new charts within this presentation. We wanted to be able to show a pretty simplistic snapshot of where we sit today on investment activity. And everyone seems to love a bridge chart, so we got a new one to look at here. So what we're looking at is the number on the left, $1.996 billion. That's the number from the Q4 Makita report. That's private markets are lagged. That's what performance reporting is based on. So year to date, we've had $86 million go out for benefit outflows. That's a $9 million a month number. We've had about $40 million of investment gain. And then our NAV currently sits at $1.95 billion. So year to date, we're up about 2.1%. From an investment return standpoint. That make sense to everyone? Okay. we'll keep this in here going forward. So looking at public market performance, year-to-date, public portfolio is up 6.6% compared to benchmark of 5. The one thing that sticks out here from an underperformance standpoint, and most of the active managers are doing well, and global equity is outperforming overall. RBC has underperformed quite a bit year-to-date and over the last month. We still maintain conviction in them, stable process and team. The underperformance has been due to the value-driven markets. They have a little bit of a growth tilt in that portfolio, and they diverge quite a bit from the EM benchmark, so it's expected that we're going to have periods of pretty significant outperformance and underperformance with that manager. So, Greg, anything you want to add on them? Or okay, we'll talk more about them in detail, too, when Greg gets to his presentation. Okay, so this is an additional new chart we added. This is as of 6/30, and what we're looking at is the contribution to total return from private markets and from public markets. So for each year, the reddish, pinkish bar is basically the private market return times the allocation. So the contribution to the overall return. So in 2017, private markets contributed 1.3% to the return, public markets contributed 4.3%, and we overall returned 5.6%. We've looked at that over the last 4 years and year to date. In that table at the bottom, you can see the allocation changes over time. So we've basically gone from two-thirds private in 2017 to two-thirds public now. So the allocations have flipped. So the amount that the public markets are contributing to the overall performance has increased over time as we have more money in the asset class. If you take this and you add it all up, cumulative return is 23.2%, and 22.6% of that has come from the blue bars. So the public markets has been essentially 100% of the performance, and the private markets has basically been flat over that time period. So we wanted to show kind of a different view of the impact of the drag that private markets have had on the return and then how the public markets have performed and what that's adding to the overall return. Looking at the asset allocation, a few things to point out on this chart. The targets here in the middle, top of the page for the equity portfolio, that's what we're going to talk about in the equity structure. And how do we want to allocate to that new 55% target to global equity? And the targets there, the interim targets that we're proposing to be approved today. And then if you look at kind of bottom right of the table here, on the safety reserve, our current allocation is $250 million to it, just over 12%. We're getting down to 9% by end of the year, so $74 million needs to come out of that cash and short-term bonds through year-end. 27 will be from benefit outflow, so that's about $50 million to reallocate over the next 3 months.
Where is that going to go then? I mean, is that
we're about $10 million underweight to EM equity and about $13 million to EM debt. So we have $30 million to reallocate this month. It'll go 10, 10, and 10 between those to asset classes and global equity. We'll top those off to the target, and then everything else beyond that will go into equity, global equity.
So what will go to global equity then? Or?
So out of the estimate here, $70 million expected to occur. We have $23 million going into the EM category. So
50-ish.
Yeah. So once we get up to target in the EM, everything will go into equity. Jump ahead, we've talked about a few of these other items, and then just looking at the calendar going forward, Greg's going to review the public equity portfolio today, and then we'll finish off with the asset class reviews in private equity and debt next month.
Yeah, I kind of re-say this every month, but hopefully everyone sees the multiple pulleys and gears that are all interconnected here, where, you know, from the situation when this new board, you know, got constituted
we've made great progress in getting out of these legacy private assets to get to a more traditional asset allocation where going forward we hope to be 80% in public,
85,
and then 15 in private. We can see the huge differential in return where, you know, we're in a group of public securities and managers that we feel like are appropriate for a system like this, and then you see how hard it is to and how long it takes to deal with legacy private assets that were not suitable and, you know, were not well thought of initially. But it takes a long time, and sometimes it costs a lot to deal with those. You know, I do say that people have probably seen headlines on June to June years of a lot of college endowments posting numbers that are in the 40s and the 50s. Someone was talking about a disappointing Harvard number that was just in the 30s. And, you know, really what's going on there is that they are with, you know, the best private investments, you know, a lot of the high-performing PE firms, a lot of the high-performing venture capital firms, a lot of them really dipped down for the first half of 2020, so the June-on-June number is off a low base, but you can really see when someone can use that private allocation and they've gotten with the best-of-breed business partners, how that produces a great return. Now, that's, you know, we're still in a recovery mode, but I really tip my hat to the whole team, how we've had a very purposeful plan, how they've executed very, very well on it, and we can see positive returns from the portfolio we want, which is taking on an ever-increasing percentage. We see how we've lowered the safety reserve, which is kind of a wartime, you know, martial law sort of phenomenon, that we're able to kind of move away from that and reduce it, and that we're getting out of these legacy assets. Sometimes we're having to take markdowns. A lot of times we're not. And, you know, all those things are interconnected with getting us to where we need to go. So, and I know I sort of restate that every month, but I think it's worth restating.
Very important.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nick.
Hey, Nick, can I add something? This is Gilbert, just because you mentioned the universities. I just want to make sure people know that, remember, their cash flow needs are dramatically different than ours because of what, you know, they're drawing down the corpus so small, and that enables them to be almost, you know, 80, 90, and very close to 100% funded entirely in alternatives. So I just want to make clear that their needs are different than ours, which gives them that luxury.
Agreed.
Any other questions, comments on the portfolio update? Okay. With that, I'll hand it over to Greg, who's going to do a review of the public equity portfolio.
John, we'll start on page 130, and for those following along in diligence. So we've got about 10 minutes. So I'll go through this relatively quickly, and Makita is following with a structure review that's going to go into more details about how the overall portfolio and how the managers interact and how that looks versus the bench. So the goal of my presentation really is to talk about who the managers are, what their role is in the portfolio, and then we'll touch on performance as well. Before we really get underway, you'll hear us talk some between public equity and global equity. Public equity is the global equity plus emerging markets. So getting underway here, the total assets under management in the public equity portfolio is just about $862 million. We try to look at the portfolio as a whole. We'll talk about individual manager details, but the goal is to have a portfolio that looks similar to the MSCI ACWI IMI, which is the benchmark index, from a style tilt, from a market cap perspective, from a risk perspective measured by volatility, and hopefully excess return as well. when you look
I guess the goal is not to make weighting differences, but to have stock selection drive the return.
Yes, that's exactly. I'd say like overall between all the managers,
right?
Collectively.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Exactly right. Yes. So briefly, we have two value managers, two growth managers. We've got Northern Trust as a passive global exposure. Eastern Shore is our U.S. small cap, and then RBC is emerging markets. We've got a few little timelines down here of how we got to this allocation. I won't go through that in detail, but the kind of importance of that is July 17 is when we implemented the equal-weighted global equity four-manager structure, and that was kind of after the redemptions we had in 2016. So we've had $385 million that we've contributed since 2016, when the portfolio actually hit a low of $155 million, and then $111 million of that has been just in the past 2 years, in 2020 and 2021. So how are we doing against our objective here? As we look at the performance, you can see pretty much flat to slightly underperformance in the short term. Over the longer term, when we're looking at 3 years and 5 years, generating about 90 basis points of excess return. The chart at the bottom shows you a cumulative excess return over time, and you can kind of see by quarter whether it was underperforming or outperforming. And just, I don't have it on the slide here, but from a risk perspective volatility, we're coming at 5 years of standard deviation of 14.6. versus the index is 14.9. So it seems to be working. We're generating excess returns with a slightly lower volatility than the index, and we're not taking a big growth tilt or a big style tilt. No significant differences in overall market cap. I want to include a chart here that shows some of the actual manager characteristics. I'm not going to go through the whole thing again here, but the kind of the highlights. If you look at the holdings, you'll see that our managers typically are going to have pretty concentrated portfolios. That's something that we want to see in an active manager, is that they're more of a best ideas portfolio. Looking down across the price-to-earnings ratios, you can see Boston Partners and Manulife are under the index. That makes sense for the value managers. Walter Scott and Invesco are significantly above the index. That makes sense for growth managers. Eastern Shore, also a slight growth tilt, and same story for RBC. The third major point is what you'll see from our managers is they typically are long-term hold. And if you're looking at the bottom part, the second line there, turnover, the big standouts, of course, are going to be Walter Scott and Manulife and RBC. But they typically are going to take a position based on investment thesis that has a minimum 5-year outlook, and so they typically buy and hold and see if the investment thesis plays out over the 5 years.
Boston Partners has 110% downside capture. Isn't that unusual for a value manager?
It is, and again, what we've kind of seen with Boston Partners is their performance has been kind of heavily affected by this big growth market that we've seen. They don't hold the big tech names that are leading the growth markets right now. So we see kind of significant variances in their performance.
And that compared to a core benchmark on those stats down there. So
yeah,
that would look different compared to a value benchmark. I don't know how much different, but.
Any other questions? All right, so getting into the manager details, we're starting really with our longest tenured manager first, which is Invesco. It is a global all-cap growth strategy. Overall performance over the longer term has been, they've been a pretty solid manager, generating fairly consistent outperformance over the long term. Now, with Invesco, they are a high beta, kind of high active share, high growth manager, so we do see a lot of performance volatility in the short term, but again, over the long term, they're generating excess returns. OFI, or excuse me, Invesco is primarily a large cap manager, but they do have some exposure to mid cap in emerging markets. It's not sizable. The other thing to remember about Invesco, the primary point would be that they are really a high conviction manager. They typically have a high percentage of concentration of the whole portfolio in their top 10 names, and their sizing is kind of based on their conviction in those names. They do have it capped at 45%, and they've lately, as the market's gone up, they have hit that cap and had to make reductions in the top 10. The next slide is Walter Scott. Again, this is our other growth manager. We've had them since 2009. Again, we see with Walter Scott pretty consistent outperformance over the longer term. Walter Scott is really a high quality focused manager. They try to avoid companies that have leverage, and specifically companies that have really low levels of leverage. We mentioned the low turnover. Walter Scott, 77% of their positions have actually been held for longer than 4 years. Walter Scott, will see, they're going to outperform kind of in a down market. Typically, you're going to provide some downside protection, but when you see really quick, sharp rallies that are fueled by growth and momentum, then they're going to lag in performance. The other thing about Walter Scott is that they do have a high focus on ESG. Next slide is going to be Boston Partners. This was implemented in July 2017. Again, this was after the redemptions. We looked at the portfolio. We had a growth tilt, so we wanted to add value managers so that we don't have that kind of growth tilt exposure versus the index. Boston Partners is, you could probably think of them almost as a deep value manager. They have maintained conviction in their investment philosophy and process and their positions. They haven't faltered, even though you can see from a performance perspective, longer term, they've definitely been affected by these growth-driven markets, but they've stayed true to their value perspective, and that's the role that they play in the portfolio, so that's important regardless of what the broader market trends are. Second thing about Boston Partners, they do provide more mid and small cap exposure, particularly versus our other managers, but also versus the index itself. And you'll see when Makita talks about the structure, how we look from an overall perspective.
And what is their anti-U.S. bias based on? Is it valuation or is it?
It is. It's primarily valuation. They also look internationally to see that they see really strong balance sheets overseas. The other thing that Boston Partners has kind of pointed out is as the U.S. markets have kind of had this big growth run, they've become a larger and larger percentage of the index. So that kind of makes their international overweight tend to get exaggerated as the U.S. grows. We talked about it. It has been a lag on performance. We're reviewing with the IEC and looking at really what the impact of having that U.S. underweight is over their overall performance. Other questions? Or so the next slide is going to be Manulife. Manulife is also one of our value managers. Manulife typically is going to be almost all large cap. When we look at performance perspective, they've also been affected by these markets that have really been driven by the high growth, high momentum names. Their performance isn't as much of an underperformance as Boston Partners for being a value manager. And as we look towards the longer term, in 10 years, and so they typically are going to have longer-term outperformance. We did see a little bit of a rebound in Q3 and year-to-date. That puts them, again, outperforming the index for those time periods.
Great. We have two growth and two value managers. We'll see in the Makita chart, but kind of
where they sit in that spectrum on the other side. They're a little bit hard to categorize.
What, with Manulife?
Well, just with all four of them, how they fit together as far as Boston Partners, a little deeper value versus Manulife, a little closer to core, and then Walter Scott, we're calling them growth, but they're more of a quality, slight growth tilt versus Invesco. It's a lot more of the tech-heavy names than a true growth manager. So, yeah, you know, don't fit perfectly in those two buckets, I guess the point.
Right. I think the other point would be that you kind of see on the style chart that they tend to offset each other in the categories. You'll see the managers. So the kind of things to remember about Manulife is they also have a big quality bias. They are benchmark agnostic, so they'll take large industry and sector bets and look different, dramatically different than the benchmark at times. And then Manulife is pretty good at providing downside protection. They've historically outperformed in kind of the down markets. Next slide is Eastern Shore, and this is our U.S. small cap manager. We just implemented in September of 2021. So the data that you see with regards to performance there is composite data. Now you'll see probably what jumps out a little bit of a significant underperformance in the 1 year. That really has been driven by their quality bias. We've kind of seen in the small cap market that we've seen a lot of the names that have run up have been actually even closer to microcap stocks, so they're the lower end of the market cap, and this just hasn't really been the quality names with low leverage. And we see with Eastern Shore over the longer term, then they have tended to outperform. The other thing of Eastern Shore is they do have a growth tilt, and we see them kind of as a specialist. They're a smaller firm with just over $1 billion in assets under management, but they only manage small cap and a mid cap product. The next slide is going to be RBC. RBC is our emerging markets equity manager. We've had them since January of 2018. RBC, from a performance perspective, is an almost a little bit of a endpoint bias in that if we looked at this chart at the end of Q1, you would actually see outperformance in the quarter to date and year to date. No doubt it's been a tough two quarters for them. And that's been driven largely by having no exposure to energy and a big under allocation to materials. They've also had some Chinese exposure that was a financial company. It was an insurance company that kind of got hit along with the general market over the Evergrande concerns. But they have pointed out that Ping An, which is the equity, doesn't actually have any exposure to that. It's just kind of caught up in the rest of the momentum there. RBC is a concentrated manager. So as Ryan said, a lot of times they're going to look significantly different than the index, and that caused some big performance differences in the short term. But as we look out over the longer term, periods greater than 3 years or so, then we just see outperformance there. The other thing that we look at on RBC, and we do kind of watch them closely because they are our only EM equity manager, they've historically had a long-running underweight to China, and that also has been a considerable factor in seeing kind of performance differences between them and the benchmark. So that's all of the managers. Do we have questions?
Okay. Thank you, Craig, for the presentation.
Makita.
Now you know who the managers are, but reminded, we'll hand it over to Makita to talk about the structure review. And as a reminder, like, this is something that needs to be approved by the board for the IPS. And it's looking at, you know, based on the higher allocation, how to allocate that 55%. So, Aaron, I think you've been on the line.
Okay. John, how many people are on the phone with me?
We're six.
Not four.
Six.
Okay.
So we're
we'll take a quick break.
Well,
I'll just check and make sure they're on the line. We'll wait for Tina.
Well, Nick and Tina are both out.
Yeah.
Summer here.
Okay.
Aaron, are you guys on the line?
Yeah, I'm here, Ryan.
I think they learned a lot about our staff retirement plan and a few other things and been waiting patiently, so appreciate it. Why don't you give us a couple of minutes? We've got a few people on break, Aaron, and then we'll let you jump into it. And then
yeah.
I got the clicker, so I'll try to drive the presentation to the page you're talking to.
Oh, you're right. We do. I'm sorry.
Sounds good. See you in a few.
Nick, do you want to start? Do you want to wait until Tina's back?
I think you should keep going because I think legal's going to take longer than
yeah,
that.
Okay. We'll get started. Go ahead, Aaron.
Okay. Good thing I didn't leave the phone.
Yeah.
So I think you guys nicely covered a lot of the background. So let's just go to 144, please.
John, is there a way to see the bottom of the page?
No.
Okay.
Yep.
What page in your presentation, Aaron? That's easier for us to...
Four. 421.
Sure. Okay. Four. Yeah. So, as Brian, you mentioned, the board earlier in the year approved increasing the equity exposure. So the whole point of this today is to kind of show the path in terms of what we, or the targets in terms of how we would like to structure the different manager allocations as we go from what is now 40% exposure up to a target of 60%. So here on 144, you can see we've got the four global managers that Greg talked about in green. Each currently has about 7% exposure as a percent of total DPFP. We've got the global index in blue at 9%, and then the EM strategy at 3%. Ryan, if you progress two pages, please.
Gotcha.
So this pie chart here is really the voting or action item. This is what we propose for full weighting. So sticking with the same order, the green managers, the global managers, their change is pretty minimal. Each would go from 7% to 8% each. The blue chunk, that's the index, that's an increase from 9% up to 15% as a percent of total DPFP. And then at the bottom, you can see a slight increase in the emerging market product from 3 to 5. And then in pink, these are the two new managers that we've been working with the IEC on. So Eastern Shore is your U.S. small cap manager. That one we would target a 4% weight. And then the yet-to-be-determined international small cap, that would be a 4% weight. So the next page, 7, this just puts it into table form. And importantly, on the far right, you can see what this means in dollars in terms of where the most money would be allocated to. So any questions so far?
Ryan, what's the timing you would think to get to this allocation?
Mid-2023.
Okay.
I mean, we've made a lot of progress this year with the rebalance, you know, lowering the safety reserve, but it's going to be a little bit slower drift with private markets coming back.
And that's Aaron talking?
Yes, Aaron.
Yeah, and Aaron, would you just sort of comment on this target versus peer groups and just from sort of a allocation and risk and so on, just some commentary on that?
Sure. Now, I would say this structure is going to be very kind of down the middle, I don't want to use the word conservative, but you're not taking a big bet relative to the universe, relative to the index. So the rest of this presentation is all pro forma what this will look like from a regional perspective, from a market cap perspective, et cetera. So you should be getting the same amount of volatility as the index. You should have similar, you know, size and regional bets as the index, with some caveats. We'll get into those. But hopefully you'll add value through the manager's stock selection.
I don't know, Aaron, if you look at the next slide, though, you've got this big U.S. underweight in the overall portfolio. Is there some way to offset that because of one manager's major decisions in that area? Or, I mean, that's the one big thing that looks out of whack to me.
Yeah, that's the caveat. And the short answer, Bill, is there is no way to offset this, given the managers in use. We stress test it, and you only have so the green is the ACWI IMI index. So if you want to increase exposure to U.S., what you need to do is invest with managers that have more, naturally, exposure to the U.S. than the index. So you go to the next page, and on the left bar chart there, you can see all the managers are underweight the U.S. So the index is in gray, and your global managers are, you know, all the colors. So if for some reason you wanted to override the positioning of all four global managers, you basically load up in the index itself and in the small cap manager, the one U.S. small cap manager. But that creates, you know, a significant size tilt to small cap.
I guess, Aaron, you're saying you couldn't do it with the current manager roster, but like down the road, if we wanted to counteract that, you could replace Boston Partners, or you could add a U.S. index.
Or you could put more in the index or something.
Yeah.
So you could do something. It just seems like, how are your other clients positioned? I mean, is this abnormal or normal to be this far off?
Generally, most of our clients have an overweight to non-U.S. versus these, you know, this broad benchmark. Now, naturally, the ones that have had the U.S. bias have done the best recently, but, you know, doesn't mean they're going to do the best going forward. And I think it's interesting seeing you have four different investment managers that all have very different styles and approaches, and all of them are doing the same thing in terms of where they're overweighting their exposure to varying degrees.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I mean, all the other managers are 50-plus percent. They're under 58, but they're over 50. Boston Partners is at 40. That's the big one.
And they've been like that for a while, but they're also the deepest value manager. So, it's been the trend, but it's kind of expected given their style being a global manager.
Yeah, but if they're going to continue and the U.S. continue. I mean, the reason people are more in the U.S. is that the growth in other parts of the world has been a lot slower, too.
No,
it's cheaper, but it's lower growth.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's a totally valid point, and I think what we need to do here is continue to look at it, take it back to the IEC in December, provide them some additional information, bring that feedback back to you guys, and make some more decisions if we want to. We maintain conviction, but it's something worth looking at for sure.
I just think if our philosophy is to be close to the index in general, we should be close to the index and try to add through stock selection. We shouldn't let one manager distort that whole thing and create these kinds of underperformance for us.
Okay. We'll take that feedback and add that to kind of the discussion in December.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else? Anyone wants to comment on this?
I think this chart is helpful.
On kind of the style tilts within the equity managers and that dot in the middle.
Yeah, Agreed. So what this chart is showing is a returns-based regression the last 10 years or so of all the managers in DPFP, and then the pink dot is this pro forma where you would be if you were at the full weight over this 10-year period. So importantly, it does end up very close to that, you know, right in the middle point. So left to right is value to growth, and then naturally top to bottom is size tilt. So I think what Greg was mentioning earlier about how you classify some of these different managers, you see where Boston Partners is on the left top northwest quadrant. But you kind of look at that versus Manulife, your other value manager. So Boston Partners is certainly further to the left, so more value, and then further down, so less large cap. And then you pair those on the right with Walter Scott and Invesco. And Invesco is furthest to the right, so the most growth, and then Walter Scott closer to that core line in the middle. So each manager has a very distinct role, and where they fall on this chart also explains how they've done in the past. So Invesco, the most growth to the right, has done your best. Boston Partners, the furthest to the left, the furthest value, has done the worst in the last, you know, in the market environment we've been in. So that's, I think, why we defend Boston Partners a lot, is that they're not, they've certainly been in an environment that's not favorable to them. So you could argue they have been wrong, but it's playing a role that, a distinct role in the portfolio. And if at some point in the future, the markets reverse and the style biases that have worked begin to not work and vice versa, you should, you know, you'll be rewarded for sticking with a group like that.
Okay. Anything else?
Anything else you wanted to hit in here, Eric? Otherwise, we can wrap
up. No, I want to go to one quick chart.
Okay.
I can't help myself.
Yes.
This is Chairman's prerogative. 161, page 21, the appendix. Every once in a while, I see a picture that paints 1,000 words. For everyone who sees the endowments doing 30, 40, and 50%, here's our 12-month equity only, public equity only number, 40%. I think that's noteworthy. The other thing is that, Ryan, you went over before, the 22% was a cumulative four-year number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means it's probably about 5% per year on average.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 5% per year with the public and the private and the safety reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a healthy system like ours should have this sort of target allocation that we're contemplating under this motion we're about to have. Here we can see what public equities have done on a 1 year to a 10 year basis. And so, you know, when I see this and I look at all the initiatives at hand, this jumps out to me as a great picture to help validate the strategy, the efforts, and the execution. And we're work in process, but we've made a tremendous amount of progress, And staff, Makita, IAC, everyone's worked together to that end. And so we should recognize that where we are, that we still have a ways to go, but we have a lot of good things that have happened that when you look at the headlines, you don't always see. But it helps provide good rationale for why we're heading in the direction we are. So that, to me, is the tee up to the motion.
All right, let's go there then.
All right.
All right, so what we're approving here is the sub-targets within this presentation across the global equity and EM equity allocations. So it's important.
What page are you on there, Ryan?
I can't see.
140.
Thank you. Approve the proposed public equity structure.
Yeah. So the motion would be to approve this public equity structure pursuant to what is in the Makeda presentation.
Yes.
As the target, which Ryan is wanting to direct us to fully implement, is probably a 2022-2023 movement to that. There'll be steps all along the way. So it's a target. We have a sense of what the time continuum is. We have the presentation. Does that encapsulate enough emotion for you, Josh? Okay. So would someone like to make that motion?
I'd like to make that motion.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you. All right. I know we're a little bit behind, so we got one more investment item before we go to closed session, which will be fun. So the private asset cash flow quarterly review. Start off, we had $72 million in Q3 distributions. That's the highest quarter we've had in over 3 years. So very good news on that front. Then I'm going to jump ahead to slide 3 of the presentation, looking at where we started and where we're at now. We ended the quarter at $545 million in private markets NAV. That's down from $666 million last quarter. So pretty big reduction from the sales and the write-downs we talked about earlier on Lone Star and Huff. The bar on the left, $1.55 billion, that's the amount in private markets in September of 16. And that we picked that date because that's before we started the secondary sales and started kind of the process in earnest to lower the allocation and liquidate the portfolio. Some of the same themes we've been harping on today and hitting and driving home is if this private markets was invested in publics across this time period, you can see the purple bar, we're down $40 million in private markets. We would have been up $430 million based on what our public portfolio performed. So it's a massive, you know, kind of putting what Nick talked about earlier into dollar terms as far as what the gain would have been. Same data, but just since the new board formation a year later here. Just quick review of the monies that came back in the third quarter. As I said, almost $73 million, the highest quarter in quite some time. 80% of the proceeds came from the real estate portfolio. Actually, 80% year-to-date has come from real estate. You see the two big sales that we've been working on for a while at the Union and Vista 7 drove the amounts that were coming back in Q3. As we've talked about, you know, to get these big quarters, there's going to be some lumpy, and it's going to be even lumpier going forward, activity that's driving the proceeds coming back. Also good news, we're starting to see some more regular distributions from the Maritime Fund. We actually saw a pretty big write-up in that fund last quarter, too, so much healthier environment in the shipping space now than we've seen, and they're talking to us about accelerating some of the distributions from that fund. So
probably going to be the best market for shipping in a long, long time.
Yeah, except when we invested in it, I guess. Their fundraising is really good. So normal income we see from the ag portfolio is about $2.5 million in the quarter and some capital calls on the Lone Star Bridge Loan and the, we should correct that, in the TRG Aero Funds, Asian Infrastructure Funds. This chart just shows quarterly activity. Blue bars going up is the quarterly distributions, and then the capital calls below that, and then the trend line. So you can see the uptick the last three quarters after it was pretty flat through 2020. Same type of data here. I'd like to use this slide just to talk a little bit about the forward projections that are making up that dotted line, and as a reminder, the detailed schedule of what is driving this by asset is included in the flow session. But we're expecting $30 million through year-end. Basically, all of it's from the AEW portfolio, or the vast majority would be from it. In 2021, we're expecting $225 million net, and it'd be a big shift in what we've seen this year from most of it coming from real estate, and the expectations or the projections next year are a lot of it's going to be coming from the private equity portfolio. As you guys know, that we have much less control there, and we're just assuming that Huff is going to sell at some point. We're going to have money coming back, so that's a big chunk of it. We're hopeful that some of the other private equity funds will start distributing money, but less, you know, surety in those proceeds coming back as compared to the visibility we have in real estate. And then on the this looks at what's currently left in the private market portfolio and how much of that is classified as legacy. So the maroon bar is the legacy assets. And as a reminder, we're assuming zero return on the legacy assets, and they're the, you know, troubled parts of the portfolio or the harder to dispose of. About half of that legacy is actually the AEW RCH portfolio. So that's the good legacy. So we actually expect to have some pretty decent returns on some of those assets, and we've seen a lot of sales from within that portfolio this year. The other half of it, so about 7.5% of the plan, is the more troubled legacy zombie fund private equity. I just wanted to put that. Not all legacy is made the same currently. So, and then this is the chart that you guys requested last time to look at the trend lines of the private markets allocation over time and how we've gotten down to the current, which is just below 30%. But, I mean, it spiked up to two-thirds of the portfolio in 16, part of that driven by the denominator effect with, you know, $1 billion walking out the door from the drop situation. So any questions on what's occurred in the private portfolio with the projections going forward would be?
No.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to go to Kelly, your report.
Yes. So okay. Included in your packet is the NC First Monitor. We have had three open records requests since the last board meeting. They were either, none of them were member related. And then the CIO recruitment is going slow. I'm hoping in the next few weeks to have a couple candidates in for some interviews. I'll keep you posted on that.
Okay. Anything else you want to flag before we go to executive session?
You might have noticed we have a new employee that was up at the front when you came in, Sasha's new admin clerk, but you might hear her on the phone when you call in. Other than that, things are good.
Great. Okay. So we'll go into